Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Global Health Forum on Blog Talk Radio. This show is a public service of People to People, a not-for-profit 501c3 registered Ethiopian diaspora healthcare organization. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapte, Chairman of People to People's Board of Directors. Our topic for this evening is kidney disease. In the United States alone, close to 30 million people have chronic kidney disease, and millions more are at risk and do not even know it. Over 500,000 have what is known as end-stage renal disease and require dialysis or transplant. Every single day, 12 people die in the United States waiting for a kidney. The statistics is even more daunting for developing countries. Although exact figures are hard to come by as renal registries are not readily available, kidney disease is a major public health problem that predominantly affects a much younger population than in developed countries. In sub-Saharan Africa, only 5 to 10% of patients who require renal replacement therapy have access to such an intervention. The growing burden of chronic diseases, in addition to the high prevalence of infectious diseases and the interplay between the two, is straining healthcare services in these countries. Joining us to discuss kidney diseases, hypertension, risk factor, and treatment modalities is Dr. Sorafel Gebreselassie. He's a board-certified nephrologist with the Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Sorafel is a graduate of the Jimba University Medical School, and he subsequently did both his residency and fellowship training at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. He's an assistant professor of medicine at the Lerner College of Medicine of Case Western Reserve University and an active member of Cleveland Clinic's nephrology fellowship training program. Welcome to the Global Health Forum, Dr. Sorafel.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So if you could start us off with a brief introduction of yourself and a general description of your nephrology practice, what kind of patients do you see?
All right. Just a brief thing about myself. Actually, I'm a product of Ethiopia's public health, public school system, rather. I went to elementary school at Bayana Merid, or what's also called Edgat Behevret, and then I did my ninth grade at Minilik Secondary High School, and then went on to do 10th to 12th grade at Black Lion. From there, I joined the Jimba, what used to be called Jimba Institute of Health Sciences, or what is now Jimba University, in 1989, graduated 1996. I worked as a general practitioner until I came to the U.S. In 2000. Here, as you mentioned earlier, I did some research training under the guidance of Dr. Paulo Sperhanu. This is at the University of Colorado. And then my both residency, internship residency and fellowship training at Wayne State, and joined as a faculty at Cleveland Clinic in mid-2008. So I have been an active participant in the fellowship training. I recently moved to the Cleveland Clinic in Florida. I see a wide variety of, pretty much a wide spectrum of patients with kidney disease, this particular focus on glomerular diseases and also kidney transplantation. But overall, I cover pretty much all spectrums of kidney disease.
Thank you. Yeah, this is a testament of the public school system in Ethiopia, and products of the system continue to excel in all disciplines in both Europe and North America. So before we start on specific kidney diseases, can you give our audience a brief overview of the kidney function?
Right. So kidney function, you know, kidneys, the primary function of kidneys is really filtration, because, its primary function is to make urine. It filters the total blood volume every 4 to 5 minutes. When you quantify it, it filters about 100 liters per day, but reabsorbs most of it, over 178 liters. So you make about a 1.5 to 2 liters of urine. Through this process, it removes excess fluid from the body. It regulates blood pressure. It filters out waste products. It maintains the chemical balance, regulates the proper pH. And kidneys are not just filtering organs. They also have endocrine function. It produces three important hormones, one of which is what's called erythropoietin, which is important in red blood cell production. It also produces a hormone called renin, which is key in the regulation of blood pressure. It also converts vitamin D into its final usable form, or calcitriol. Other hormones such as prostaglandins are also produced. Kidneys are also important in degradation of hormones such as insulin. So it's a complex organ. Now, if you look at the structure of the kidney itself, each kidney has about a million nephrons. Nephrons are really the filtering units. So each nephron constitutes what's called a glomerulus, which is an extension of capillaries that eventually leads to the ultrafiltrate. And you have tubes or tubules, which are about a cell thick, but they are key in the reabsorption and secretion of unwanted substances, and which eventually becomes really a urine.
Great. I think this will give our audience a good appreciation of the kidney physiology and function. Let's now go to some of the common pathologies of the kidneys. And let's start with what is known as the acute kidney injury. What are the most common causes, and how is it usually diagnosed and managed?
Right. So acute kidney injury, it's actually an abrupt decrease in kidney function. So you have, normal kidney function over days, could be weeks. When you have this abrupt decrease in kidney function, that's what you call it, acute kidney injury. For most part, it actually recovers. Okay, for patients who developed acute kidney injury, for the most part, they actually recover their kidney function. Now, it's a common problem. About, for example, if you look at hospitalized patients in the U.S., about 20% of all hospitalized patients and up to 40% of all critically ill patients in the United States could develop acute kidney injury. The causes are several. This could lead to shock state, for example, when you have a bad infection, for example, where we call it sepsis. If you have severe diarrhea, if you have trauma, it could be medication-related, such as drug toxicities. And even in some situations, exposure to, for example, contrast dyes that we use for imaging, such as CAT scans, can be causes of acute kidney injury. Now, if you go out into Africa and other parts of the world, you start to see infections like pyelonephritis, for example. In a study done in Ethiopia back in the 80s, septic abortion, malaria, particularly P. falciparum malaria, tend to be leading causes. So now acute kidney injury can progress. Again, for the most part, it recovers, but it could still continue to progress into a chronic kidney disease, or even what we call it end-stage kidney disease, or a kidney failure that requiring some form of kidney replacement therapy, or what we typically call a dialysis or even kidney transplantation. If you look at what are really, how do you go about it? So let's say, I come to the hospital and rounding, I see a patient with acute kidney injury. The way we really know this is through a blood test, and that particular test we check is what's called creatinine. Creatinine is actually comes from the muscle. It's a non-enzymatic production by the muscle. It's only filtered out by the kidneys. So we use it as a surrogate marker for kidney function. So the higher the creatinine, the lower the kidney function. So you will see this elevated creatinine. There are other markers as well, such as urea, nitrogen, or what's called BUN. You look at electrolytes, sodium, potassium. You look at urine and you do urine analysis. You may pick up proteins in the urine, for example, blood in the urine. You look at some abnormal sediments or cells in the urine. You know, the evaluation could also involve imaging. For example, a kidney stone can block the urine flow and can lead to acute kidney injury, which, you know, could be easily picked by an ultrasound or a CAT scan. So it's really, this is how you approach it. Now, I want to emphasize, like in any medical condition, physical history and physical exam are still keys. So particularly for audiences who are listening, medical students in Ethiopia, still the focus has to be in history, because here you can pick out if a patient has nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, medications, for example, some analgesics that can be used over the counter. If a patient, for example, has autoimmune diseases such as lupus, so the history, you can pick up on the history if the patient has joint pains, rash, the presence of blood in the urine, family history of kidney disease, for example, you know, sometimes genetic diseases of the kidney, like polycystic kidney disease, you know, that runs in the family, you can pick out of the history. A very good physical exam also can point out, for example, finding what we call a pericardial rub can point to a pericarditis as a result of kidney failure. So history, physical exam emphasis, and then supported by basic urine tests and also imaging. The challenge in some parts, particularly in developing countries, is this creatinine is not really routinely performed in many hospitals, including in Ethiopia. I think this has improved over time, but that remains a challenge. So, for example, in one study published in 2013, acute kidney injury was only identified in a cohort of patients in the medical ward. Patients in the surgical ward didn't really have this testing. So this is going to be key, you know, going forward if we really want to improve our diagnostic abilities.
So we can presume then acute kidney injury, you know, progresses to chronic kidney disease and undiagnosed and unidentified in the early cases if the, you know, routine lab tests are not done. So as you mentioned, and most of acute kidney injuries, if adequately supported, may resolve, but others may progress to chronic kidney disease. And if you could tell our audience how that is defined and how it is staged, when do you say you have chronic kidney disease?
Right. So the again, as far as treatment, for example, in acute kidney, even before we go to the chronic kidney disease, you can, for example, high hydration. Somebody comes in with profuse diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, and who develops acute kidney injury or acute kidney disease as a result, you know, high hydration could just be the answer. Avoiding medications that can potentially have toxic effect on the kidney, you know, or those things. And sometimes also making, you know, it may not be straightforward. For example, a person who comes in with a rising creatinine in a short period of time, who may have blood in the urine, protein in the urine, may need a biopsy diagnosis, particularly to pick out some conditions such as what's called glomerulonephritis, which is inflammation in the kidney that sort of destroys the filtrating process. So that's important. Now, chronic kidney disease is defined as abnormality of kidney function or structure that's present for more than 3 months. So you've got this persistent abnormality, because acute kidney injury would have improved by then. So that's what the definition of chronic kidney disease is. Now, again, like in acute kidney disease, the causes could be broad. And the first thing is really to identify the cause and looking at, you know, what are the risk factors for chronic kidney disease. Now, some of the common causes of chronic kidney disease are hypertension, diabetes. For example, one every four patients with hypertension can have chronic kidney disease. One every third patient with diabetes can have chronic kidney disease. As I mentioned, inflammation in the kidney, what we call glomerulonephritis. It could be inherited diseases, like, for example, where you have many cysts building in the kidneys called polycystic kidney disease. So the identifying the cause is key. When it comes to staging, there are five broad stages of chronic kidney disease. Stage one is when the filtration rate is greater or equal to 90 milliliters per minute per 1.73 meters square. That's what we call stage two, or normal, near normal kidney function. Stage one. Stage two is when that filtration rate is between 60 to 89, which is mildly decreased. Stage three is when the filtration rate is between 30 and 59. Now, stage three can be subclassified into stage 3A, which is 45 to 59 milliliters per minute per 1.73 meters square body surface area, or B, which is 30 to 44. But in general, when somebody comes to you and says, you know what, I just saw my doctor, he told me I have stage 3 chronic kidney disease, what they mean is their filtration rate is between 30 and 59. And then stage 4, which is severely decreased, is when the filtration rate is between 15 and 29. And now stage 5, what we call actually kidney failure, is that's when the filtration rate is less than 15 milliliters per minute per 1.7 meter square. Now, the question, of course, the audience would have is, how would I know? Now, this is really calculated. There is ways of directly measuring the filtration rate, but those are cumbersome. Typically, we use them for very selected patients or in the research situations. For the general public, most labs done in the U.S. will actually give you a filtration rate or a GFR, if you see on the lab slip or when you pick up results. Now, otherwise, you can also access it online. If you actually, you can easily Google it. Some of these calculations would have, and this, you can also access it from the National Kidney Foundation website. You plug in a few things. You plug in the creatinine. You plug in age, sex, and also race, whether black or non-black, and that gives you an estimated filtration rate. And based on that, then you can have the stages. Now, it's important not to do the staging for acute kidney disease, because acute kidney disease can recover. This is particularly for chronic kidney disease.
Hey, yeah. Thank you. So let's talk a little bit about hypertension. As you mentioned, it's an important part of your practice and then one of the major causes of chronic kidney disease. And according to the CDC, one out of three U.S. adults have high blood pressure, and then they don't even know it, some of them. It's known as the silent killer, as it has few symptoms, and people do not even know that they have it. So how is hypertension diagnosed and treated?
Right. Hypertension is a key preventable risk factor. I think when it comes to hypertension, it's really, the thing about hypertension is, unless it's really severe hypertension, then, you know, a person may not have symptoms. You know, of course, if you have very elevated high blood pressure, you can have headache, you know, not feeling well. But in general, you know, especially mildly elevated blood pressure may not give you symptoms. So I think what's important is really to have, you know, every opportunity to have at least your blood pressure checked. Now, it's also important to really know where you are in terms of the stages. Now, the national, the seventh report of the Joint National Committee on Prevention, Detection, Evaluation, and Treatment of High Blood Pressure outlined a very simple classification, which is that a normal blood pressure is considered when the systolic blood pressure, that's the top number, that's when the heart is beating, that's less than 120 millimeters of mercury, and the lower number, that's when the heart is relaxing, that's what's called diastolic blood pressure, which is less than 80 millimeters of mercury. That's considered normal. Now, what is defined pre-hypertension is when the top or the systolic is between 120 to 139, and when the bottom or the diastolic number is 80 to 89. Hypertension stage 1 is when the top number is between 140 to 159 and when the bottom number, or when the bottom number is between 90 to 99, or stage 2 hypertension is greater, as we call it, to 160 millimeter of mercury on the top number, than greater or equal to 100 millimeter of mercury. So those are really the definitions. So one can check, see where they are, if they are on a prehypertension, for example, they or in different stages, they can always make lifestyle modifications. The first really approach to treating is to identify risk factors, because some of these risk factors include obesity, for example, age, of course, as advancing of age, particularly the systolic blood pressure tends to be high. Family history is key. Blood pressure or hypertension is twice as common in those who have hypertensive parents. We tend also to see more commonly, more severe, and tends to occur earlier in life and with greater organ damage in blacks. The decrease in number of nephrons, as I mentioned earlier, each kidney has about 1 million, and the decreased number of nephrons, it could be some evidence that maybe even the birth weight during intrauterine, development, that may also contribute. More importantly, a high salt intake, particularly if you take more than 3,000 or more than 3 grams per day, high salt intake, excess alcohol intake, physical inactivity, diabetes, high cholesterol, all these things are risk factors. So people can modify these risk factors. And so with lifestyle modification, that would be the first thing. And then when I say lifestyle modification, I specifically mean, maintaining normal body weight. So weight reduction for obese or overweight people, eating a very healthy lifestyle, such as adopting a diet rich in fruits and vegetables, low-fat products, dietary sodium restriction, as we mentioned, regular aerobic physical activity, such as brisk walking, for example, something that the person tolerates, and of course, importantly, also moderation of alcohol consumption. Those are all key factors. Now, once you try this, if that's not effective, together with your physician, primary care doctor or nephrologist, then drug therapy, can be used. And there are really several drug classes of medication. There's quite a few out there that can, can be picked out and used to treat hypertension.
Okay. And if you could just briefly tell us the difference between a primary and secondary hypertension. I'm sure there will be some audience members who've heard of secondary hypertension.
Right. Secondary hypertension is, what we call a secondary hypertension was you find an identifiable cause for that hypertension, and hence you really target that identifiable cause. For example, one such cause of secondary hypertension could be what we call a primary hyperaldosteronism, which is when the adrenal glands have excess production of the hormone aldosterone, which leads to salt retention by the kidney. And that situation, could lead to low potassium as well, one of the signs, the clues, rather. So picking things like that. Another would be, for example, if there is blockage to the blood flow to the kidneys, what we also call as renovascular hypertension, which could be, especially younger individuals as well, we call it fibromuscular dysplasia, could be genetic, particularly in younger females. And then the other one would be in older individuals, it could be just atherosclerotic disease. Other things like using medications such as what we call NSAIDs over the counter, especially if you use them for a prolonged time, use of steroids, some even decongestants, medications, for obstructive sleep apnea, for example, things like that. So, when you pick out the secondary causes, that's that's when you're really looking for making interventions accordingly. So that's really where people say they are secondary. And you typically don't look for this unless they are obvious. What you really evaluate this is, for, especially when you see what we call a resistant hypertension on more than three medications, and blood pressure is not controlled, and one of them is at least a diuretic. For the younger individuals, when you see hypertension, when you have early family history of hypertension, so, and when you have clues, again, like low potassium, things like that, that's when you start to really look for. And so if your blood pressure is not well controlled, then I think you can talk to your primary care physician and maybe have a referral to be seen by a nephrologist or by a hypertension specialist who can really look for all the secondary causes.
Okay, so we already discussed hypertension as one of the most common causes of chronic kidney disease. So what are the, you know, other consequences of untreated or inadequately treated hypertension?
Yeah, so hypertension, if untreated, is inadequately treated, so that could lead to stroke, of course. You know, it could lead to heart disease, heart failure, particularly, you know, stroke could be very debilitating, right? So I mean, those would be, the main things. It could lead to, particularly if you have accelerated hypertension, malignant hypertension, very severe hypertension, could lead to encephalopathies. Yeah, and so hypertension is, untreated hypertension is a killer.
All right, so the take-home message for our audience is important to get screened for your blood pressure and get blood pressure treated as early in the course as possible. And quite some of them could be treated with just lifestyle modification. Otherwise, there are a lot of potent, effective medication before you get the consequences of untreated or inadequately treated hypertension. We already discussed some of the diagnostic workup for kidney disease. One of the questions that came up was whether the risk factors and the epidemiology of chronic kidney disease is very different in developing versus developed countries.
Right. So, I mean, this is an important question. The challenge is we really don't have very good data coming from particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, for example. So if you look at, for example, the situation in Ethiopia, it looks like the this is unpublished data from Tekor Ambassa Hospital, which is a leading, it's a main teaching hospital in the country. Chronic glomerulonephritis and diabetes and hypertension, those three. Glomerulonephritis coming first, diabetes and hypertension seem to be the leading causes of chronic kidney disease in Ethiopia, for example. Now, if you look at, in general, chronic kidney disease, it's at least 3 to 4 times more frequent in Africa than developed countries. If you look at some statistics, for example, in South Africa, hypertension accounts for about 25%. Now, if you look at hypertension, for example, in Ethiopia, the prevalence of hypertension varies from 10 to 30% in urban areas such as Addis Ababa, Gondar, for example, Jimma, and then to about 1.8 to 10% in rural Gondar, Sidamo in the south. If you look at one well-done study involving over 3,000 adults in Addis, about 31.5% of males and 28.9% of females had hypertension. That's using blood pressure readings above or equal to 140 by 90 millimeter of mercury. On the other hand, if you look at diabetic nephropathy, by the way, the 7 out of 10 patients with chronic kidney disease are as a result of diabetes and hypertension here in the U.S. Okay, so when you combine those two, they're the majority. Now, if you look at diabetic nephropathy, that's kidney failure as a result of diabetes, that accounts to about 14 to 16% in South Africa, about 23.8% in Zambia, about 12.4% in Egypt, about 9% in Sudan. And when it comes to Ethiopia, that statistics is somewhere around 6%. Right? So, hypertension, diabetes, they're still common, you know. Now, the challenge with glomerulonephritis, again, is we really don't have diagnostic facilities, you know, robust diagnostic facilities. So it's very hard to sort of get a true, you know, prevalence or data as a result, but that seems to be in pediatric population, for example, if you look at the condition, what's called the hemolytic uremic syndrome, this is a condition that could lead to kidney failure, typically post after diarrhea. That seems to be a leading cause in children in Addis Ababa, for example. So here you have, again, a role of diabetes and hypertension, but inflammation or what you sort of as a whole put it as glomerulonephritis, I think seems to be also a leading player in Africa.
All right, great. We're almost at the halfway mark of our program, and I would like to remind our audience that you're listening to the Global Health Forum, a public service by people to people. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapte, and my guest this evening is Dr. Sorafil Ghebreselassie. He's a board-certified nephrologist at the Cleveland Clinic in Florida. He was elected chief fellow during his nephrology training at Wayne State and was teacher of the year at Cleveland Clinic in 2012. He has written book chapters in nephrology and published peer-reviewed articles. We invite you to be an active participant of the show. You can ask your questions or share your comments by dialing 646-595-4742 and press 1 if you'd like to speak. You can also email your questions and comments to info@peoplepeople.org. So I'm going to open up the phone and I'll invite the first question from 203-623. Go ahead, please.
Good evening, Dr. Antenna, Dr. Sorafel. Thank you very much. We appreciate the show as usual. I like the fact that you go much deeper than the usual, headline type way of addressing questions. So I really appreciate it. Thank you for the service. My question today is about I have a father who has been using a fair amount of herbal supplements. And, you know, because of the availability and such, it seems like, you know, people tend to perhaps medicate themselves. And what he also does, though, he also combines it with over-the-counter medications for pains and aches. Now, my concern is that, you know, would some sort of a drug interaction with herbal supplements affect his liver or his kidneys? So far, all his blood work is fine, and his doctor didn't seem, you know, overly concerned at all. But are there particular medications he should stay away from?
Yes. So thank you for the question. So I think a situation like your father, I think it's probably better addressed on a sort of an individual basis with his physician, because what we typically look at is, you know, what is the specific medication, what is his level of kidney function, in general, let's say if you have a low kidney function or if you have a kidney failure, particularly if also the potassium is high, if there is hypertension, we in general recommend, not to use, particularly for a longer period, the NSAIDs. You know, those are over-the-counter pain medications. The thing about herbal medications is always is a challenging, because sometimes, you know, those medications really not well studied. So it may be difficult to really discern all the side effects. So my general take on this is probably will stay away on herbal medications. But if the physician, you know, his primary care physician felt like he's comfortable with that, it probably would be okay. It's very difficult to come up with a general conclusion. Now, having said that, you know, this, I'm not really saying all pain medications or particular pain medications are necessarily bad for everyone, you know. So I just don't want to give that impression. But, you know, but patients, particularly patients with kidney disease, I probably would in general recommend to stay away from prolonged, you know, or long-term use of medications such as NSAIDs.
All right. I'll take one more question before I start discussing, you know, dialysis, renal replacement therapy, and transplant and such. So one more question from 203-623. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a question in regards to hypertension. I'm trying to determine how effective are fish oil and calcium supplements in the treatment of hypertension. I've been taking those supplements. I exercise regularly. I've been limiting my salt intake in an effort to come off of my high blood pressure medication. Currently, I'm on 25 milligrams of hydrochlorothiazide. I'm healthy otherwise. I don't take any other prescription medication.
Right. Okay. Thank you for the question again. So I think what's key here is to really look at what are the major risk factors. Okay. So I think what you tell me, you exercise regularly. If you don't have weight, I think you're doing all the right things. You're cutting out salt as much as you can. I think you're doing all the right things. You know, most people actually require at least a minimum of two medications to get their blood pressure under control. So you're actually doing very well with just one medication. Right, so I think, and remember, each medication also does a few millimeters of mercury, you know, decrease in blood pressure. So I would suggest that that I wouldn't really take off. Of course, if you do, then you have to really touch base with your physician. When it comes to supplements, the fish oil, I'm not aware of any particular study really looking at fish oil or calcium supplements to really lower your blood pressure. We typically don't recommend those. I mean, of course, if you have vitamin D deficiency, there has been some data looking at perhaps vitamin D deficiency could be a risk factor for hypertension. You know, vitamin D deficiency, you know, replacing it properly, that's important. But short of that, you know, when it comes to, with typical routine practice, if a person comes to me, I see them in the office, you know, if I can manage their blood pressure with one therapy, if they're really doing all the right things, they're cutting salt, they're doing physical activity, no excess alcohol, they're losing weight if they have weight on them. And then if I don't have any evidence for secondary hypertension and one treatment alone, I think that's you know, that's a good, to me, that's good. Now, taking off a blood pressure, again, for example, a person who loses weight, you know, were overweight, when they were overweight, they had diabetes, high blood pressure, and then they lose weight, significant amount of weight, then they may not need that. Again, working with a physician, then they could potentially could get off of those medications. But I would be careful just to be off of the medication, though, because the chances that after some time your blood pressure starts to go up, and especially if it's not closely monitored, and as you know, there's not a lot of side effects with hypertension, and before you know it, there is already straining in the heart and other side effects.
All right, great. I really want to go to dialysis and transplant, but before that, I want to read one email question because it touches on a topic we've not discussed yet. This is from Sarah in Richmond, and she wants to know what causes kidney stones and whether drinking a lot of water helps prevent it.
Oh, okay. All right. That's so we haven't touched the kidney stone. Whole topic. We may have to come back to kidney stone as a whole. But there are actually four major types of kidney stones. There is the primarily it's a calcium stone. These are either calcium oxalate stones or calcium phosphate stones, which accounts about 70% of stones in general, of kidney stones. The second most common is actually uric acid stones. And then that's about somewhere in the 10 to 20% range, and then followed by what we call struvite, which is related to recurrent infections. I think in recent studies, including data that we looked at Cleveland Clinic, showed that struvite stones are decreasing over time. And then, of course, the last one is cystine stones. Cystine stones, actually, you see them more often in children and less common in adults. Now, so in general, the rule of thumb for people who form stones, because stones are actually formed in the tubes, in the tubules, when we discussed earlier about the structure of the kidney itself. You've got the glomerulus, the blood is filtered, you have that ultrafiltrate, and whatever is excess is actually becomes a urine in that tubes. That's where you actually form stones. So if you have excess calcium, you have as a mineral such as oxalate, there, you've got phosphorus there. So the calcium then will bind to the oxalate, to the phosphorus, forms, starts as a nidus and, becomes a urine, becomes a stone. So if you have excess uric acid there, for example, and then also if you have excess salt. Now, salt, particularly if you eat a lot of salt, it actually puts you at risk for kidney stones, because what happens is that the kidneys, particularly the tubes, the early part of the tube, it's called the proximal tube or tubule, the proximal tubule, if you have excess salt, it's going to let it go. So then with it follows calcium. So now here you have a lot of calcium in the urine, and then bind this with the other minerals we just mentioned. So that is how a stone is typically formed. So we if we don't know the type of stone, and most people don't, because unless you catch a stone or you had a procedure because a stone is blocking the urine flow and you have to get it removed, or because a stone is giving you a lot of pain and you had to have surgery for that to be removed, or different procedures. So if you have a stone that you coat then or retrieve during this procedure, that you can have that stone analyzed and identify what exactly that stone is composed of, and then you can have strategies to minimize the stone risk. But in general, though, if you really don't know what stone it is, then the rule of thumb is we encourage patients to drink or to hydrate themselves. Now, again, working with your physician would be important, because, sometimes excess fluid also can have its own side effects. So it has to be tailored to the individual. But if you ask me in general, I think hydrating is important, because you're trying to flush out particularly the small stones before they really, or the crystals before they really form. As a rule of thumb, again, we recommend to lower salt intake. By decreasing your salt, you're not having a lot of that salt with it, calcium in the urine. We also recommend to moderate protein intake. So if you have a lot of animal protein in particular, that can be metabolized into acid, and that could also be a risk for kidney stone formation. Then specifically, for example, a person who forms a calcium oxalate stone, if they particularly have a very high amount of oxalate in the urine, one test that we typically do, especially in patients who form frequently, who form stones, we do a 24-hour urine collection, and that the patients do at home, and we actually measure the amount of calcium in the urine, the amount of oxalate in the urine, uric acid in the urine, citrus. For example, citrus is protective from stone. When the calcium binds with the citrus, it's more soluble. So citrus in the urine, having a lot of citrate or citrus in the urine is actually protective. So, you know, we do those things, and we, based on that, we make specific recommendations that tailors that individual person. For example, if we see a lot of salt in that 24-hour urine or sodium, then we recommend, you know, to decrease it. Now, if we find a lot of calcium, for example, then it could mean that there are conditions that actually leads to high calcium in the urine. For example, the parathyroid gland, when the function of that is high, parathyroid gland is a gland which is in the four little glands in the adjacent to the thyroid. If they have excess function, it's called primary hyperparathyroidism. That could lead to a lot of calcium in the urine, and that could put you at a risk for stone. So the stone, I mean, those are rule of thumbs in general: hydration, low salt intake, moderating protein intake, and minimizing risks. For example, you know, medications such as excess amount of vitamin C and certain medications can also put you increased for particularly the calcium oxalate stone. So this would be the general way I would see it. But, but specifically, again, it has to be tailored to you based on some more testing.
You're right. This is a whole other show. Maybe we'll come to it some other time. So let's proceed to dialysis. What does it entail, and what are the common indications for dialysis?
Right. So dialysis, what really means is, you know, this is one of the options that we have in the treatment of kidney disease. So if you have kidney failure, as we mentioned, when you have that stage 5, when the filtration is less than 15, then, and when patients start to have symptoms of what we call it uremic symptoms. So when the kidneys can no more really get rid of some of the waste products, then patients can have symptoms. This could be nausea, this could be vomiting, this could be like having a metabolic test, you know, not eating. It could lead to unable to get rid of the fluid. It could lead to leg swelling, for example. Electrolytes such as potassium could be high because the kidney is not able to get rid of them. And when it gets advanced, if it's not treated, it could lead to confusion or what we call encephalopathy. And sometimes it could lead to inflammation in the linings of the heart, what we call pericarditis, or even acid buildup, or what we call metabolic acidosis. So these are some of the symptoms that really lead to that, to make that decision for the initiation of dialysis, which is technically means really cleaning the blood and returning it to the patient. Now, dialysis is one of the most important discoveries of the past century, because, and this is really was out of Dr. Kolff, who actually did constructed the first dialyzer, which is you can call it artificial kidney. That's in 1943. He at the time was working at the in a university hospital in the Netherlands. The first dialysis machine, he used sausage skins, orange juice cans, a washing machine, you name it, to really create this device to clean blood. And then once the Second World War ended, he actually donated the 5 artificial kidneys to hospitals around the world. So some of them stayed in Europe, I think to London, Amsterdam, and Poland. But he sent one to the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. So the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York was actually the first to perform the first human dialysis in the U.S. That was in 1948. Now, when you look at dialysis in Africa, for example, there was actually a good movement early on. The first dialysis machine was built in Africa back in 1957 in South Africa. There recently, Dr. Barsu from the Cairo Kidney Center, and also Dr. Aro Gundat from the renal unit of the Obafemi Awolowo University in Nigeria. They published a very nice review of the history of dialysis in Africa in the past 50 years in the American Journal of Kidney Disease. And then if you look at their paper, very, very instructive paper, back in the 50s when everybody was sort of trying to get this, so did South Africa. And then the Cairo and Johannesburg University Hospitals were actually doing both peritoneal and hemodialysis in the early 1960s. 1962-1963, followed by Tunisia, Algeria, and one in Kenya. Now, I introduced here peritoneal dialysis. Now, peritoneal hemodialysis is when you really take out the blood, clean it, return it, use a machine, clean, return it to the patient. Peritoneal dialysis is actually used the belly itself. The peritoneum is the lining of the, you know, it covers the intestines. And so when you actually put a cleansing solution, or what's called dialysate there, it can be used as filtering. That peritoneum can actually help get rid of some of the waste products. So that's what's called peritoneal dialysis. So both were actually, again, used, and following Cairo and Johannesburg, then Tunisia, Algeria, and Kenya, also developed in early 1960s, then Nigeria in 1965, Sudan 1968, Libya in 1972, Zimbabwe in 1972, followed by Morocco in 1977. But if you really look at the whole African continent, there are only 8 African countries who had the resources to achieve a sustained national program capable of doing adequate dialysis. Now, at least 100 dialysis patients per a million population. Now, these countries are Egypt, Libya, Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, South Africa, Mauritius, and Gabon. They only account for 21% of the African population. So Sudan and Mauritius have also a robust program, but, you know, not reaching to that level. But the rest of the countries in Africa actually don't have, at least until this paper is published not too long ago, a national program. Now, when we say national program, this country's governments entirely cover the dialysis expense in state hospitals, and they support private dialysis wherever available. When it comes to peritoneal dialysis, it accounts about 10% of dialysis population in Kenya, 20% in Uganda, up to somewhere in the mid-30% range in South Africa, Senegal, about 40% Sudan, even higher, about 50 to 60% in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. Those two are, again, the modalities of treatment. But the best treatment for kidney failure or non-reversible, non-reversible kidney failure, or what's called end-stage kidney disease, remains a kidney transplantation for the appropriate candidate. Now, if you look at the African continent, there are only 12 countries who have a kidney transplant program: Algeria, Egypt, Ghana, Kenya, Malawi, Mauritius, Morocco, Nigeria, Rwanda, South Africa, Sudan, and Tunisia. Now, Ethiopia is almost there, though. Ethiopia will soon be one of them. There is, when I visited Ethiopia not too long ago, the St. Paul's Hospital is almost up there, doing most of the work already. So you see this. So still is a challenge. I think care for end-stage kidney disease is really a challenge in developing countries. So I think the focus still has to be on prevention, early diagnosis, prevention, controlling blood pressure adequately, managing diabetes appropriately, and also improving diagnostic facilities to make a diagnosis of glomerulonephritis, treating that. And while you do that, particularly if you do it under a national program, then, you know, focusing on kidney transplantation and maybe using dialysis, particularly a peritoneal dialysis, as a transition to transplantation. I think this seems to me, in my opinion, a better approach to address this.
Sure. Thank you very much. That's a very comprehensive, you know, historical perspective about where things are in Africa in particular, and then in Ethiopia. You know, it's conspicuously missing from both the dialysis and the transplant list, but that, as Dr. Sorafil just described, hopefully will be coming soon. Before we end, let me try to take a few more questions. I'll take area code 571, please. Let's try to make it brief with the, both the question and the answers, because we've got so many people lined up. 571, please go ahead. We may have lost that caller. Area code 703, please.
Hi, great discussion. Can you talk about the role of genetics in kidney disease? And also, what are the early signs of kidney disease?
What are the early signs?
And also the role of genetics in kidney disease.
Yes, so genetics, the role of genetics in kidney disease, that's a very important question. One, there are few diseases which really have a genetic, you know, implication, one of which is actually polycystic kidney disease, adult polycystic kidney disease. Now, this is where one develops many cysts. You know, the cysts just keep on growing, and they sort of crowd out the functioning part of the rest of the kidney. The cysts can grow and eventually lead to kidney failure. In general, there are at least two patterns within this polycystic kidney. There is a PKD1, PKD2 gene, and the clinical presentation is a little bit variable. For example, those who have a PKD1 tend to have a little bit more faster progression, and then a PKD2 will be a milder presentation. There are also other genetic conditions. For example, mitochondrial diseases that can affect kidney. There are, for example, you know, autosomal recessive, again, polycystic kidney diseases. If you look at children, for example, in the pediatric population, particularly when a kidney disease is diagnosed early on, some of the congenital diseases can actually be the main, birth defects, hereditary diseases could be up there, especially from birth to age 4. There are nephrotic syndrome. You know, the nephrotic syndrome can have some genetic conditions of the nephrotic syndrome. When I say the nephrotic syndrome, that's when the kidney sort of the filtering mechanism of that kidney, the glomerulus is really inflamed, and then you allow massive loss of protein in the urine. And with it comes a lot of swelling, you know, it can lead to kidney failure. So some of this could be also genetic and inherited. If you look at some common diseases such as diabetes and hypertension, you tend to see this tendency to have it, in, you know, for example, hypertension. If you have a parent, you're twice as common to have hypertension, but the specifics of those are not very well defined. So so there may be more than, several factors that's playing a role. But I think that's in general. Now, coming to your second question, what are some of the early signs? So that's a challenge with kidney disease. Kidney disease may not have symptoms, you know. So that's where I think routine checkup, you know, is important, because by the time most people have symptoms, it could actually be late. So because, again, kidneys have good reserve, but you really don't have much of symptoms unless So that's where I think it's really important. But, you know, again, fatigue, anemia is important because, again, kidneys are endocrine organs as well. They produce this hormone erythropoietin. So with kidney failure, you have less of that anemia. You know, patient can be tired, fatigued. Some signs, for example, one of the most common causes of secondary hypertension, I may not have mentioned this, is kidney disease itself. With kidney disease and hypertension, it's sort of like the chicken and egg situation, you know, when one can lead to the other. So, you know, uncontrolled hypertension could be a sign. Blood in the urine could be also a sign of kidney disease. And, you know, protein in the urine could be a sign of kidney disease. These are some of the things. But early screening, especially in high-risk groups, is important. When I say high-risk groups, patients with high blood pressure, diabetes, patients who have cardiovascular disease, you know, patients who have family history of kidney disease, you know, those obese patients, you know, so having that screening is important.
Okay. Let me take one more caller and we'll have to wrap it up. Area code 310, please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Fitzum Brahanamaskal. I'm calling from Los Angeles area. I always think about donating a kidney when I hear about all the people who die while waiting for a transplant. I worry, though, that I may need my backup kidney sometime in the future. Do people with one kidney do just as well as people with two kidneys?
That's an excellent question. So when it comes to leaving, you know, there's nothing like giving, you know. So and giving a kidney is one of the precious things that you can do to the recipient. It's fulfilling, it's satisfying. There are people donate to their families, friends, parents, kids. There are also altruistic donors who actually donate to people they've never seen, never heard of. Now, in general, you know, when we, for example, when I evaluate a patient for who comes in to donate a kidney, you know, my primary goal is to protect that person, okay? And my primary goal is to make sure that that person is healthy enough and is not at increased risk of kidney failure in himself or herself. So when you do it, in the centers here, for example, in the States, you follow a very rigorous protocol of evaluating that person as a donor. The first thing, for example, we look at is what is your filtration rate in the first place? You know, so you need to have a robust or a normal kidney function to begin with. Because when you donate a kidney, even if you're giving one kidney, the other kidney compensates. You actually, so let's say somebody has 100 milliliters per minute of filtration. The moment they have the surgery to have that kidney removed and given, then that drops by 50%. But within a few weeks, they actually recover 25-30% of that function because the other kidney compensates. So in general, giving kidney donation is safe. But as a potential donor, you know, the things you need to know, there may be a slightly increased risk of elevated blood pressure after a few years of donation. And also there are some studies showing that maybe a slightly increased risk of kidney failure after 15 years of donation, particularly when this is done within a related, you know, close family. But in general, though, it's really safe, and you can live a healthy, full life with one kidney. And remember, some people are actually born with one kidney, or they have very, or just have one working kidney for different reasons. So I think the current programs that exist in the centers here, they really make sure that that particular donor undergoes through rigorous evaluation, testing, checking blood pressure. For example, if you're a diabetic, you're not going to be a candidate to donate, you know, things like that. So, you know, people who have kidney stones in both kidneys, they won't be a candidate to donate. So things, so they go through this rigorous process in centers, including ours.
Okay, unfortunately, we'll have to wrap it up here. I apologize to callers who've been, who didn't get a chance to ask their questions, but if you forward them to our account at info@people.org, I will make sure that Dr. Sourafel gets them and addresses your questions. So I'd like to thank my guest this evening, Dr. Sourafel Ghebreselassie, who's an assistant professor of medicine and a staff physician at the Department of Nephrology and Hypertension of the Cleveland Clinic in Florida. He's the recipient of several awards and honors as a medical student during residency and fellowship training and later as faculty. Sourafel is also an active blogger who writes on a variety of topics, including reminiscing on his days at medical school and general observations in life. And we're delighted that he'll be joining us as a moderator here at the Global Health Forum, hosting the fourth Thursday of the month. So thank you, Sourafel, and welcome aboard.
Well, thank you very much.
And I want to thank you, the audience, for tuning in to the Global Health Forum. And we invite you to join us every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. As always, you can help shape our program by submitting your comments and suggestions through info@peoplepeople.org or People to People's Facebook page. And if you're unable to tune in live, you can access the archived show using the link on the People to People website. And a program update before I sign off, next Thursday, May 14th, Dr. Tunsai Warata will be hosting Dr. Celine Gounder, who's an infectious disease specialist and a physician journalist in New York City. Dr. Gounder has worked with the PEPFAR project in Malawi, Lesotho, and Ethiopia, and has served as the Assistant Commissioner and Director of the Bureau of Tuberculosis Control at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. She recently returned from a trip to Guinea, where she was involved in the response to the Ebola epidemic. So Dr. Gounder will be sharing her experiences on the trip and other health issues of global significance. So please check our website for more details on upcoming topics and guests. I'm your host, Dr. Anton Hapte, and I'll be back with you the first Thursday of next month with another segment of the Global Health Forum. Thank you, and stay tuned.